Good evening and welcome to First Edition on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Thursday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9 and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or you can subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That's my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or you can go to my Facebook page if you have information, insight, or breaking news that you want to share with me. I'll share it with the people, unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Coming up in the second hour of the show, it is a special one-hour episode of the infamous, the notorious NWA Sports Report, talking Orioles baseball in the first segment. Dexter Fowler reversing course and going back to the Cubs. I've seen it all. We'll talk about that, and we'll also dig into the latest NBA news with the usual suspects, Uncle Perry L. Crawford, Claudette, Cravante, Dr. Dre, and Ramos, all coming up on the NWA Sports Report in the second hour of the show. But in the first hour, it's serious stuff. We continue our series, Conversations with the Candidates. This evening, focusing on the 1st District, City Council candidates for the 1st District in Baltimore City. They are Zeke Cohen. Zeke, welcome back.
Thank you.
Mark Parker, welcome back.
Good to be here again, Sean.
Scott Goldman, welcome back.
Thank you, Sean.
And Mark Edelson, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
All right, so this is what I want to do. First of all, let me hand these out to you. That will give me a reason to talk about this. Pass that to your man there. That for you. And one for you, too.
Thank
all right,
you, sir.
Yeah, y'all should come through. The mayoral, WEAA Baltimore mayoral debate 2016, Thursday, March 10th, from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at Murphy Fine Arts. The theme for the event is Ask, Listen, Vote, Solutions, and Strategies for the Future. Seating will be open to the public. In addition, the debate will be aired live here on WEAA. Residents can engage moderators and candidates via Twitter through the recently launched At Baltimore Debate using the hashtag Baltimore Debates. I know you all aren't invited to this. It's a mayoral debate, but I think it would be beneficial for y'all to come through, and we would be happy to see you come through. This is going to be an important discussion. There have been a lot of them, but this one is going to be an important one. I want to talk in the first segment about public safety. I had a conversation this afternoon with a gentleman who a very well-connected, powerful gentleman in the city. I'm not going to say his name, obviously. But we had a brief discussion about the ability or inability for us to lure, for lack of a better term, policemen, police officers to live in Baltimore City. What is the best way to compel them to stay in the city? And his argument was he wasn't that sure that it was that big of a deal. He was more concerned with other things. I conceded his point. I don't necessarily agree. What are your thoughts about residency for Baltimore police officers? Is it something that's important? I think the residency rate for Baltimore police is around 20-21%. The commissioner was in here on Tuesday, or he went in here, but we talked on Tuesday. He said it's about 21%, and he did agree that that number was not acceptable. What are your thoughts about residency for Baltimore City police officers? I'll start with Zeke.
Sure. So, you know, given the fact that so much of our city's budget is going to our officers, I mean, around $445 million, that's almost twice what we give to our own school system. I actually think it is really important that our officers live in the city of Baltimore. Otherwise, we risk becoming a jobs program for somebody else, be it Hartford County, Baltimore County,
New York,
or actually, yeah, out of the state. So I think it is really important. I think the mayor's proposal on providing incentives is a good start. Long term, this is a cultural problem within the Baltimore Police Department, and it's about building bridges between our communities and our officers. Until there is a sense of connection, until there's a sense of reciprocal respect, until our officers feel valued and our residents feel valued by our officers, I think it's going to be a tough sell to get more police to move into Baltimore. I also think that long term, we need to recruit from within and think about how we can make becoming a policeman a more attractive job to young people here in this city. Because right now, the reality is that it is not. For a lot of the young folks that I taught and continue to work with, there is a fear and an anxiety about the police, which I think derives from the tactics that our city has implemented to police many of our communities. And so long term, we need to recruit from within. Short term, I'd like to see some incentives. And last thing I'll say is that, Sean, we know that our crime problem is a jobs problem and is a poverty problem. Our police alone cannot solve this problem. And so we really have to be creative about how we can bring more jobs and more economic opportunity into Baltimore if we want to get serious about lowering our crime rate.
Scott Goldman, I'll go to you next.
Thanks, Sean. I mean, you're never going to take care of a place more than you're going to take care of your home. And so I think it's obviously important that we have police officers who are here in Baltimore. And you hear, you know, I've talked to, listened to Commissioner Davis talk about transitioning to the new community policing model as a transition in culture from having a sort of a warrior mentality of policing, in which case I guess the city then is sort of an occupied area, to a guardian mentality, where the police are guardians working with the community and protecting the community. And I think it has to be part of that. If they're guardians, they should be, you know, the more the merrier living here in the city. Really, the trick is just how does it work?
How do we do it?
I mean, I agree everything that's been said. Incentives, that's a start. I mean, I know there have been proposals to compel it, but that's just, it's not legally possible.
Right.
And I think that's a great, I agree with Zeke's point about recruiting. I mean, in Southeast District has a program called the Explorers Program, where they partner with high school students at Patterson High. And it's sort of like a junior ROTC for police training. And they teach them the sort of discipline and the methods and the process of being a police officer. And some of those students grow up and they're interested in it. And I think programs like that throughout the city, you know, restoring the police athletic leagues, creating that connection, I agree. You know, we can do everything we can to try and bring the police who are on the force now into the city. But the long-term solution is that it's got to be a Baltimore police force from Baltimore City.
Before I go to you, Mark Parker, I would throw this into the conversation and onto the table as far as this recruitment, bringing officers into the city. The argument that the gentleman that I was speaking to this afternoon made, was one of the arguments was that police officers complain that if they live in the city, they are perhaps they and their families are subject to retaliation from individuals in the city. Now, that's an interesting argument given the fact that there are police officers that do live in the city, and I wonder if that is something that they experience on a regular basis, or if at all. I don't know the answer to that. I'm going to investigate that, but I just wanted to throw that on the table. So, Mark, what are your thoughts?
Sean, I'm glad you bring that up. It is a tricky situation, right? So police officer residency is a symptom of the underlying problem, which is the falling apart of police community relations in general, which makes it more difficult for officers to live here and work here and more difficult for citizens to enjoy a productive and safe and respectful relationship with the officers. I have personal friends who are police and are married to police who have experienced and had to leave the city because of intimidation. Now, they were living in a rougher part of Southeast Baltimore, just outside the First District, and they were coming home every night to threats being made against them and their spouse at the house, and messages really? Left, and rocks in cars and things like that. And so they moved to Harford County for that reason. I also have friends on the force in Southeast Baltimore who live across the street from me on Highland Avenue and who love it and are deeply embedded in the community and wouldn't be anywhere else. So I think it has a lot to do with the community you're in and also where you're patrolling versus where you live. I think police residency is also tied into residency in general. I mean, the same factors in terms of affordability, in terms of safety, in terms of cultural life and education that drive other people out of the city,
sure,
drive officers too. I think the incentive program helps because it makes it more possible for officers at their current rate of pay to afford to live in neighborhoods where they would feel comfortable and feel safe and trust that that they can raise their kids, You know, so I think the incentive helps to do that. I think that one of the things moving forward, we can't compel officers certainly live here legally, but I think it'd be interesting to explore including residency as one factor in police advancement, right? In say when you take your sergeant's exam, there's a lot of factors involved in that, the exam itself and your rating and your history, and you're going to rate out in a certain place. What if residency is part of that, right? Or what if residency to say, like, listen, we expect our commanders to have a better understanding of the city and to be more committed because we're going to give you more responsibility, we're going to pay you more, we're going to put more on your shoulders. What if that was not a requirement but was part of how you rate? So if you're an equal to another candidate, but you live in the city and they don't, well, then you're going to slot up a little higher, right? I think that's worth exploring.
Interesting. Mark Edelson.
So I think we can take this whole conversation, Sean, and boil it down to two things. And I have spoken to many officers that live in the city and many that don't. And it is those two main factors. It's safety and it's affordability. And the safety piece is a genuine fear of reprisal for them and their families. And the affordability piece is they simply cannot afford to pay the property taxes in the city to own a home based on the salaries that they make. So if we want to have our officers live and work in the neighborhoods in which they are policing, which I do think will be a huge step towards building trust, we have to get over those two hurdles. The issue that I have with the proposal that Mark just made, and while I think on its face it's a positive one, the concern is if we don't remove those two hurdles, being safety and affordability, you're going to be giving officers a leg up to climb up the ladder who don't have those issues. So for instance, an officer with a wealthy family who doesn't have the issue of having to pay property taxes that he cannot afford is going to have that factor in his favor if he can live in a community that other officers simply cannot afford to live in. Mm-hmm. So that's my concern, is you might not have the promotion of the best possible officer when you have that kind of extraneous factor. But we have to remove the barriers of safety and affordability in order to incentivize our officers to live in the city.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host, as we continue our conversations with the candidates. This first hour, we devote to the First District City Council candidates in the First District. They are in the studio with me. They are Zeke Cohen, Mark Parker, Scott Goldman, and Mark Edelson, you just heard from. So what is coming out, what I'm hearing from all four of you, and I think that it's a sentiment that is echoed by a lot of people, is, you know, in order to attract police officers to stay in the city, we have to work on making the city a better place generally for everybody.
Absolutely.
I mean, that seems logical. You know, I where I work out in Queen Anne's County, I hear there are a lot of police officers there. There are a couple who are Baltimore City cops, others from other jurisdictions, and, you know, this isn't going to surprise anybody, I don't think, but there's this whole mentality of this Baltimore is almost like another planet. That is incredibly, I think, a harmful mentality to have for people who come into our city and are supposed to be public servants. I really want to cuss right now, but I'm not. I'm on the air. But it's breathtaking to hear some of the stuff that I hear, like on the slide. They don't know that I'm from West Baltimore, that I went to Walbrook High School. You know, I just lift weights and mind my business. But that mentality is the thing that is so disturbing to me. Let me ask this question. I was thinking about this the other day when I had a meeting about the whole notion of zero tolerance. We have callers who call in. One cat in particular, Ott, who talks about reparations, and the thing that I've said over and over again is that if you start talking about reparations on a national level, that's a dead end conversation. It's just not going to happen yet. No one on the national scene politically is really ready to have that conversation, really. But I'm believing that the conversation about reparations is more viable on the local level, perhaps. Tied into that, as far as law enforcement is concerned, thousands of men who were arrested during the zero tolerance era under Martin O'Malley still have arrest records, were arrested, not charged with anything, up to 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, still have arrest records, still have that mark on their record. There were people that were arrested during zero tolerance that spent a month in jail, lost their jobs, some lost their homes, some lost their families. There were people that spent 72 hours in jail, lost their jobs. Is it possible, from your perspective as prospective candidates for the first district, city council first district, is it possible, is it right to begin to remedy some of the people that suffered immensely under zero tolerance? Is that a path that this city council, the next city council of Baltimore City should take? Is that something that we should embark upon? I'll start with Mark Edelson.
So I'll give you my perspective on this, which I think is going to be a little bit different from everyone else's. But we've talked about this before, Sean. I was born in South Africa. And what I was a witness to as a child and growing up was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was really sort of a stunning showing of people's ability to forgive and the importance of someone coming forward and saying I wronged you. And for that, I apologize. And these are all the things that I did that were wrong. And even that kind of a statement went so far to mending the relations in the country between populations that had for so long been torn apart. It was an incredible sort of case study to see. So to that extent, I do think that there is benefit to be had from that kind of an approach, which is an acceptance of wrongdoing and a genuine attempt to make someone whole for the wrongdoing that was done. I mean, the other thing is we can look at the type of policing that we do now. Obviously, zero tolerance didn't work. And the fear is that community policing as a model in many places has been manipulated into a form of zero tolerance, right? In that we see a broken window, and the theory now has become instead of fixing the window, we arrest everybody who's standing anywhere near the window. Mm-hmm. And so I think until we change that entire culture of how we police, we're not going to be able to move forward. And I think that a policy of, you know, one, apologizing for the wrongdoing, and two, genuinely attempting to make someone whole for the effect that it's had on their life, is a step in the right direction.
But when you say make someone whole, what do you mean by that? What specifically? What would we do to begin to make someone whole who literally lost a lot for essentially no reason? They lost a lot because there was this tough guy policy that was implemented, and it arrested 100,000 people in a city of 630,000 people one year. I don't. Where else on earth do you make that comparison? It's nowhere on earth. We are singularly guilty of that type of policing on the planet. So when you say, I hear what you're saying about apologies and all of that. But when you talk about making someone whole, how do you do it? Is it even possible in the context of city government, Baltimore city government, to actually do that? Can we do it?
I don't think we can fully make someone whole. I think a step in the right direction for sure is expungement of all of those records.
Okay.
Because having that record right now is going to prevent that person from getting their life on the right track and finding a job. And an expungement of that record is going to help them to move in the right direction. And I think that's a step.
Okay. Zeke, what do you think?
So, you know, when I was teaching in Sandtown, I remember walking around and just being shocked by the paucity of men in the neighborhood, right? You see young women, you see children, and you'd see elderly women. You would very rarely see men. And I remember asking a pastor about it and him saying, "This is your war on drugs. How do you like it?" And, you know, to me, it represented such a loss, not only to those men that were taken out of the community, but also to their families and the damage it did to the children that I was teaching. It's enormous. Not incidentally, we're spending $17 million per year just incarcerating people in Sandtown alone. So it is not a fiscally conservative policy to lock people up. And that's why I think you're starting to see some convergence around criminal justice reform. What I would do to repair would be to make sure that there's a lot of development in our district going on, right, around the harbor, around Canton, in some of the neighborhoods. I would like to make sure that our returning citizens have access to those jobs and that we as the city council play an aggressive role in bringing together project labor agreements where returning citizens have first dibs at some of these jobs, where our unions and then where folks that have a criminal record are able to get put onto construction projects, because those are decent jobs. I think that's where we got to start, because like you said, Sean, at the end of the day, real damage was done and folks need to have a way to get back into society and to be economically compensated.
This is what we're going to do. We only have 2 minutes left in this segment, so I'm going to take a phone call. I will give you gentlemen opportunity to answer that question when we come back after the break. But let me take this phone call real quick. Let's go to Keith in Baltimore, who has a question and comment. Keith, you're on First Edition. Thanks for calling.
How you doing, Mr. Yost?
All right, brother.
And to your guest, my only question is I wanted to really understand that how their views is going to be when it comes to how the rest of the city should be appreciated. I mean, things are going in the first council district as far as crime and housing and everything like that. I don't see the blight in the first district that I see all over the rest of the city. I just want to know what will they do to contribute to the other districts. That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. I mean, from what I, you know, that's an interesting question, because I mean, you're city council people, but your priority is the first district. I mean, that's accurate, right?
So I'll bite at that. So I'll say no. I'll say the priority of a council person is to represent the people in their first district with an eye towards the well-being of the city as a whole.
Okay.
I'd say that part of while I agree with the single-member districts that we moved to in the last decade, one of the things we lost was a sense of connection. Hmm. And especially in the first district, I think we've become really parochial, right? And I think the caller's right that a lot of times the issues and concerns of the first district don't always seem to match up with the reality of life in other parts. I would disagree a little bit. Where I live in Highlands Town in Baltimore Highlands, you know, we've had 6 house fires of houses that were vacant or drug houses in the last 6 months. And so I certainly see in my neighborhood, and we're working on the effects of blight and street level dealing and murders. And so there are parts of the first district that share some of the broader issues in the city. But I think the role of a city councilperson moving forward has to be to mobilize the resources and the leadership and the creativity of the first district to be of some use in addressing the broader issues of the city, that it can't be. And we'd actually be doing a disservice if we kind of hunker in place and take care of our own and let the rest of the city go on its way.
Okay. All right. So this is what I'm going to do. When I come back from the break, I'm going to let Mark Parker and Scott Goldman answer the question about reparations. Then I'll come back and I'll let you, the remaining three of you, answer that question that the caller put to you all. We're talking to the candidates. We're having our conversation with the candidates on First Edition. Stay tuned. Welcome back to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host, as we continue our conversations with the candidates, focusing on the First District of Baltimore City Council. Candidates in the studio with me are Zeke Cohen, Mark Parker, Scott Goldman, and Mark Edelson. Interesting conversation, gentlemen. I promised that I would allow Mark Parker and Scott Goldman answer the reparation question. Mark Parker, since you just talked, I'm going to go to Scott Goldman first about the reparation question, directly applicable to the zero tolerance policing policy and the thousands of people, mostly black men, who continue to suffer because they were arrested, not necessarily charged, but lost time. Some lost jobs, some lost homes. We're talking about whether or not remedying that situation is something that could be pursued by the Baltimore City Council. So, Scott, I'll let you go first.
First, let me say, when I got married, the rabbi called me Scott Goodman. So, no worries. This is not a big deal.
You're right. When you put it that way,
as long as it was right on the contract, I think that's
okay. Yeah, no, it worked out. So, this obviously a more serious note. zero 100,000 arrests in a city of 600,000 people, mm-hmm. and it's not that one in six people got arrested that year. Some people got arrested many times mm-hmm. that year. And the reality is, and this is true, I mean, in almost any situation where you're talking about reparations, you can't ever fully repair the damage that's been done. For someone, you know, the loss of the financial loss, the dignity loss, mm. the, you know, you can't undo what's been done. That said, though, I do think we should have the question was, can we have a conversation about this, how to try to make up for it? And I think we should. And I think a lot of good ideas are out there, and we've talked about certainly expungement. If there was some type of priority system for to look at expunging on a faster way, in a faster basis, those who were affected by this, you know, opportunities for job training. You know, you can't fully make someone whole after something like that, but we can move forward, and we can ask people too to be a part of how we transition to a new policing model. People who did suffer under zero tolerance policing can be ambassadors for how we do a better job going forward. And I think that's something the city should put together. And you know, it's a program the police could design and the city could design. And I think we can use our you know, the mistake of the past to make sure we don't repeat it.
Okay. Mark Parker.
Sure. So zero tolerance policing certainly cost those individuals and their families a lot. And I think it's also important to recognize that in so doing, it costs the city a lot. It costs the city economic activity. It costs the city stable family structures and neighborhoods where people were able to contribute to the sense of well-being. And so it hurt. You can't speak of people being hurt without saying the city as a whole is being hurt. You could certainly dedicate city resources towards reparations if that's what we thought was the most effective way to establish justice for those people. And really, that's what we're talking about, is we're talking about what justice looks like moving forward. I think that the best way to invest those limited resources would not be to try to establish a reparation system, but it's to make sure that the way we're spending our scarce resources now is a way that that makes sure that the concerns and the needs of communities that have been most affected and most neglected and most ignored are priorities. So make sure that our policing actually is serving them rather than injuring their well-being. It's making sure that when we invest in schools, that we're not closing schools in the most hard-hit areas of the city, right? And making sure that our investments are actually geared towards people in those areas and people who are most affected. It's making sure that TIFs, when we allocate a lot of our financial resources on tax revenue as a city, that it's going to long-term job creation, right? It's like along the Browning Highway corridor that's going on. That's going to long-term job creation that provide people graduating high school or technical school with family-supporting jobs. That's a worthwhile use of our resources that gets towards what justice would look like for people that have been damaged in the city, rather than, you know, multinational corporations along the waterfront, right? Mm-hmm. That's compounding the injustice that's already been done when we take our tax revenue and spend it to help those who weren't injured by all of that.
Okay, so let's move back to the question that Keith posed about priorities beyond the first district for city council people. Mark Parker, you got to answer that question, so I'll start with Zeke Cohen. What are your thoughts about your responsibility as a councilman or a prospective councilman from the first district as far as the rest of the city is concerned?
I think it's an important question. I think that one of the real challenges in the past with our city council has been the fragmentation, the segregation within sort of the silos of the city council, right? So each council person is scrapping for resources within their own district, is fighting real hard to get their roads paved or the rec center or whatever, and it doesn't take a long-term look at what we all need. And we all know that these borders are arbitrary, right? Like, what happens north of Fayette Street is going to bleed down south of Fayette Street. That line doesn't matter. And so I think if sort of the uprising and this year of violence that we've had has taught us nothing else, it's that we need to work together and that we need to reach out across lines of difference, be it race, class, literal geographic lines and start talking to each other and figure out how we can make these things better. Because if we continue to have areas of deeply concentrated poverty above Fayette Street, then the First District is not going to do well, even though that's not our district.
Okay. Mark Edelson.
Sean, I think that it's not just an important question, but Keith's question is the single most important issue facing city council candidates in this race. And to me, it gets to a critical point, which is balance. Balance is what we've lacked for so long, because if all you have is the long-term vision for what you think will benefit the city, but an inability to deal with basic constituent services in your community, you're failing your community as a councilman. But if your sole focus is about constituent services and you're unable to have a vision that's going to affect the city at large, you're also similarly ineffective as a city councilman. And that balance is what's so important, and I think Keith hit right on it with his question. To me, it's sort of a combination of what the guys have said tonight. I do think that bringing the private investment into the city is a crucial thing. We grew economically at 9% in 2015. Even if you take out Horseshoe Casino and the Canton Crossing, the city still grew economically in 2015. Mm. The key has to be taking that economic growth and making sure that it is tied to real jobs for the residents of our community, to affordable housing, to transportation infrastructure that's going to connect the different areas of our city to one another and to opportunities. And frankly, my campaign has been focused on that, and the support that I've received has been a mirror image of that, because I've received significant support from folks in the business community as well as the unions, because they see that that balance is what's so important between being good with constituent services and having a long-term vision. And our city is deserving of leaders that are capable of both.
Mm. Scott Goldman.
Yeah, I guess I'll actually take a kind of contrary position. It is my priority. My first priority is to get things done for the people of the First District. That's what I'm running to do, and I'm going to do constituent services, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that the people of the First District are being served and have an advocate and a partner in making the First District better. But here's the thing: the most important thing I could get done for the people of the First District and for Keith, who whatever district he lives in, is to work together to make the city government more functional, because the biggest problem facing people of the First District and the entire city is the dysfunction in our city government. And whatever the service is, whatever the issue is, without a city government that is answering questions and is easy to navigate and is serving people, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, all the policies, all the efforts we can put together, all the collaboration, it's not going to work if the actual gears of the machine don't turn. And so for Keith and for everyone in the First District, I'm going to be working hard to get things done for them and make sure their city government works for them.
Mm. So, okay. Let me ask a question. I don't know the answer to this, so I'm going to trust you all to answer it accurately.
So there's no right answer, is that what you're telling me?
There may be a right answer. I think there is. All you gentlemen happen to be white, sitting at the table. Is everybody running in the first white?
No.
No.
Okay. No. All right. Okay, then I'll strike that question.
So no, there was a right answer.
No, I was not sure. I wasn't sure, but I can still ask the question.
It
didn't matter. The issue of structural racism that has come up often. It's, you know, people will ask me, is it an appropriate question to ask in the context of Baltimore City politics, and why wouldn't it be? Clearly, I've been saying for years, I'm a student of the history of this city. I've said on the show a thousand times, Baltimore literally invented segregation back in 1914, Barry Mulhall, whatever his name was. But we crafted the first ordinance of segregated housing in the United States. And that segregation still thrives today in Baltimore City. And with it isn't just a separation of racial groups or cultural groups. There are opportunities and that become are kept apart or kept away from certain groups as well. I mean, that is that what you know, part of what segregation is all about. How does city council, under the next city council that we elect, how does the next city council begin to, in a viable way, begin to kind of deal with the issue of structural racism within Baltimore City? I know that's a broad question, but I mean, in my mind, it should be a priority. I'm curious to hear what you all think, and I will start with Mark Parker.
Sure, I appreciate it, Sean. So I happen to serve as pastor in a neighborhood that's roughly one-third white, one-third African-American, and one-third Latino. And it's an exciting place to serve because it looks to me and it feels to me, for all the challenges that we have, like where Baltimore needs to be heading and like where a lot of other cities already are in terms of the mix of incomes and backgrounds and cultures, trying to figure out what community looks like together. And certainly very different from the Baltimore I grew up in, where two blocks south of me was the line between white and black, right? It was Henrietta Street. Mm-hmm. And they had the playgrounds, and we had the swimming pool, and we didn't share, right?
That wasn't a very equitable. I mean, nope. Especially during the summertime.
Nope. Well, and to top it all off, the swimming pool is a private club, so middle-class kids like me couldn't get in either. Oh, so there you go. Right. So that being the case, it's been a really good place to try to work at the community-level aspects of racial reconciliation and understanding, right? So within Highland Sound and Southeast Baltimore broadly, there's been an initiative called Neighborhood Voices, which is about bringing people together from different backgrounds to tell their stories, right? And that part of what begins the process of dismantling racism on a systemic level is within a community listening to each other's experiences and having a deep appreciation and respect for what other people have experienced and are going through now. If you want to look at dismantling structural racism on a citywide level, you have to kind of have to start to untangle each piece at a time, right?
Sure.
So it's looking at the racism that's embedded in our policing and making sure that whatever's happening, both in terms of in-service training, in terms of tactics, and in terms of at the academy, right, that racism is not something that we ignore but is talked about. Like, this is how it has affected our policing in the past, and this is what we need to do to change that in the future, right? It's looking at our housing policies to make sure that even though racial segregation is against the law, that the application of the Fair Housing Act in Baltimore City has not resulted in many mixed income or mixed ethnicity communities, mm-hmm. right? To look at how our housing choice vouchers are concentrated and create pockets of deep poverty and often kind of monocultural situations, right? It's looking at our transportation investment and making sure that that communities, especially in West Baltimore, that we're going to benefit from the Red Line, aren't undercut or torpedoed by advocates in wealthier areas like Canton who thought it was disruptive and so helped to scuttle the whole project, right? I mean, it's trying to help build those bridges and say, like, no, our policies, piece by piece, are affected by this, and so you take aim at each one at a time.
Mm. Man, you guys, y'all really want to run for Baltimore City Council? My God. We've got a lot of challenges, really. That is an understatement. Scott, I'll go to you next.
Yeah, I...
Having second thoughts now?
No, I'm just...
All right.
I'm laughing at the question. Yeah, I do want to run for Baltimore City Council. And it's because of how much I love the city and how much, when I think about, my nine-month-old, where he's going to grow up, you know, I think about the city he's going to grow up in. And, you know, when I get this question, I think a lot about my experience in the Army. I was in the Army for 5 years. And the Army, you know, certainly people are still people. But because of the structure of it, the incredible hierarchy where your rank on your chest or on your hat is so telling to your authority and your position, that's the first thing you look at. You don't look at color of someone's skin. You look right at their rank, and then you think about their job. And there's this entire system in place where, over time, you know, obviously racism hasn't been eliminated from the military, but it's a different place. It has a different feel. And you know, certainly we can't apply that level of total discipline to our lives here in the city so that we, you know, eliminate racism. And you can't do it through legislation. That's the reality, too. The city council, there's not a single bill that will eliminate structural racism. The key is to recognize it, though, and to talk about it, and to lead by example, and to look at every place where there is a choice we can make, whether it's in housing or whether it's in hiring, to be conscious of it. And if, you know, as long as we're doing that, as long as we're still having that conversation, I think that's the most and that's the best thing the city council can be doing right now.
Zeke?
So I would disagree with the assertion that we can't legislate in a way that is explicitly anti-racist, right? So I think about policies like pre-kindergarten, having pre-kindergarten in Baltimore, which we know number one public investment for helping to close academic achievement gaps. I think about the choice we made to cut rec centers over the last 5 years. I think about the choice our governor made to get rid of the red line. I think about the choice we made to do zero tolerance policing. And these are all, I would say, explicitly racist policies in that they disproportionately impacted people of color in a negative way. And that part of our job as the city council is to reverse that trend and is to embrace an openly anti-racist agenda, which frankly is a challenge in a district that is mostly white, right? I mean, it's a challenge. It's an uphill battle. That piece is so deep in our city of people just feeling segregated and not seeing their interests as being inextricably linked. My work up until this point has been about teaching young people, mostly young people of color, how to organize and advocate and build power. And just one example I would talk about was we got involved a couple years back in helping to pass the DREAM Act. And a lot of my students, African-American from Baltimore, initially very skeptical of the DREAM Act, felt like, yo, this is something that's going to take away from us. It's a tax break for illegal immigrants. I don't want to do it. But when they actually met with Eves and Mariella and JJ, these kids from El Salvador and Dominican Republic, and heard their stories and saw their own stories in these other students, they saw that actually these kids being able to get an education will not only benefit them, but it'll benefit me as well, right? Because they'll grow up, they'll pay taxes, they'll contribute, you know, they won't spend time in jail, which we know is expensive. And so I actually think it is an obligation of our next city councilman in the first district all the way through the 14th district to acknowledge that we live in a city that has been defined by segregation and to fight back against it.
Mark Edelson, your thoughts.
So I disagree with both Scott and Zeke, frankly. I don't think that simply having the conversation as councilman is enough, to Scott's point. But I also don't think that specific, explicit, racially driven policies is the right move either, to Zeke's point. And I come at this from a unique angle because as someone born in South Africa, I grew up in a country, an entire country that had experienced generations of institutional racism. And frankly, having moved to America 16 years ago, as an immigrant, I know exactly what it's like to be an outsider. And to me, when I look at the policies in our city, the most important one that I think that is holding us back now is our transportation system, because that to me is the specific manifestation of where our racially segregated system is now, because it denies folks in our city opportunities. And what I mean by that is I speak to a lot of folks in the port community on the east side. I speak to a lot of folks in small businesses, and they often say the same thing to me. In the port community, they say, I have good living wage paying jobs that I could be given to people in the city. And in the entrepreneurship community, they say we have internship programs, we have mentoring programs, but folks in the city cannot get to those opportunities. And until we bridge those gaps, we're not going to be able to move forward as a city. So to me, a much more progressive transportation policy that truly connects people to each other and to these opportunities, that's the key forward.
All right. Let me take a phone call. Brother Owen has a question. Let's get into the conversation. Brother Owen, welcome, bro.
Thanks, Sean. Hey, guys. My question is, what's one policy or initiative that you've prioritized based on conversations with the community about increasing access and opportunities for under-resourced youth? And then to follow up on that, so we're not comparing apples to oranges, what's your position on the city's current plan to move the ice rink that's currently in Patterson Park, which is a very diverse neighborhood, to the Canton waterfront?
All right. Thanks. Thank you all. We don't have a lot of time left, but I'll try to move with a bit of alacrity on this question. I'll start with Mark Parker.
Sure. So I'll start with the ice rink first. That's where my son's learning how to skate. He has the benefit of being able to walk there from his school and go. He went there three times in December to with his kindergarten class, learn how to skate. And we took 26 young kids from our neighborhood there the other week. It would be a real injustice and I would say a perpetuation, I mean, in some ways, of it certainly would have a racist impact to move the ice rink from an accessible location that is close to a lot of young people and families of color and also families of poverty, which is a huge public benefit to them, away to whether the waterfront, which isn't apparently going to happen, or to an industrial area close to I-95 where it would be really accessible to suburban hockey teams, but really inaccessible to kids in Southeast Baltimore. To a broader issue, I'd say, and Zeke and I have both been involved in this, but the Youth Works program is a positive thing, but man, could really use a lot of attention. Certainly expanding it is a really good thing. Last summer we were able to get 8,000 kids working. We just had 320 kids come through our church for their interviews for summer jobs this week. What it really needs to do, though, is to get connected to what Mark was talking about: internships, mentoring programs, long-term, real, sustainable jobs and job skills that can connect people to the private sector. Right now, it functions as a nice summer experience, but there's no follow-up. There's no coaching. There's no job training. It needs to be more.
All right. Scott Coleman, what do you think?
So to increase opportunities for under-resourced youth, I think the City Council should make it a priority to make the community schools program the standard in Baltimore City schools. So the community schools program, a community schools has a dedicated liaison or social worker whose job it is to connect parents and students with social services. And the schools that have done this successfully have found that it bridges a gap beyond just education, that students who are having problems, learning, sometimes it's an issue of access to health care or to legal issues. And having that community schools liaison to connect students makes a big difference. And the council, right now there are a little more than 50 community schools. I think the council should make it a priority to find the funding and set up a system to find the next 50 community schools. As far as the ice rink, the Patterson Park Master Plan process has revealed that the ice rink itself is falling apart, is the way they describe it. A new one needs to be built. I agree. If we can keep it closer to the core of the district, the better. And certainly there's an opportunity as well, instead of an ice rink, as we expand the space in the Canton Waterfront Park, as that there's a DPW sort of staging area that's closing. If that could be a green space or another type of public space, there are other uses for it. But we'll, this is an ongoing planning process.
Mark Edelson.
So the ice rink is a fantastic community space that we need many more of in our community and, frankly, in all communities around the city. So I think that we need to maintain that type of environment, and I think moving it to the two potential locations is going to be a huge loss. On a personal level, I cannot seem to pick up ice skating, no matter how many times I try. I'm horrific at it. But I know that a lot of folks in the community get a lot of enjoyment from it, and that's very important. On the jobs piece for our kids, that's a huge piece of my platform. And I was speaking to folks about a week or so ago that work at the Plumbers and Steam Fitters local. And they have an internship training facility on the east side at their complex, and they cannot seem to fill it. And this is exactly what Mark was talking about, which is a long-term jobs training program for our kids to have multiple pathways to success in a real skill that's going to give a real good you know, paying wage for a long time. And they tried to partner with YouthWorks, and it was just completely unsuccessful. Mm. And this is where our city council should be playing more of a role, because YouthWorks, it's a good program. It's a good start. The follow-up is not nearly good enough. Here is a program that is a real long-term one, and that's the kind of partnership we should be putting into place to be funneling our kids into these real opportunities for a lifetime job.
And Zeke Cohen.
Yeah. So I held an event last night. It was a celebration of teachers, because I think it's a hard job and not one that's often celebrated or recognized. And so we had about 68 teachers come out in the middle of this monsoon that was taking place last night. And I asked them what we could do to do better by the young people that they teach. And two things came up. One was to actually infuse more health and mental health into our schools. So in a city suffering from a mental health crisis, probably similar to what Scott saw in Afghanistan, the fact that when I used to teach, there was one school psychologist who split time between my school with 240 kids and another school, that is completely unacceptable.
Absolutely.
Every one of my kids pretty much had been traumatized. Had experienced violence, had PTSD, or was currently experiencing trauma. And so building some kind of partnership between our schools and our health department around mental health, I think, is critical. The other thing, and I've been saying this a lot lately, but our teachers echoed it, is I think pre-kindergarten is the smartest investment we can make. Making sure that our working and middle-class families are able to send their kids to school early. When we think about how we're going to integrate Baltimore City Public Schools, I think if we're going to do it, it's got to start young. And we know that it is a fiscally smart investment. There's an economist that says that every dollar invested yields $6 to $8 over a child's life. And you see places as diverse as New York, Washington, D.C., and Oklahoma, not exactly Bernie Sanders territory, doing universal pre-K. I think we should in Baltimore.
We have got to make that the last word for this conversation. Strong conversation, gentlemen. I appreciate all four of you coming through and talking with us and exchanging with our listeners. I want to thank Mark Edelson, Scott Goldman, Mark Parker, and Zeke Cohen, all candidates for the First District of Baltimore City. Thank you, man. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
Good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, NWA Sports Report, baseball and basketball. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.